Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Alex Knott with the Center for Public Integrity, who assesses the recent indictment of Republican House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. Michael Gorman, president of the American Library Association, who explains why he strongly objects to the Patriot Act gag rule imposed on librarians when the FBI seeks private records in terrorism investigations. And Glenn Morris, of the Colorado American Indian Movement, who discusses the history of Columbus Day and efforts underway to challenge the adulation of Christopher Columbus and transform the holiday. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The BBC reports hundreds of Pakistani women marched on Parliament demanding a public apology from President Pervez Musharraf, who boasted in a recent interview with the Washington Post that rape allegations were a way for women to make money and immigrate to the West. Musharraf later denied making the comment while at the United Nations summit, but the Washington Post put an audio clip of the interview on its website, backing up its story. According to the Independent Pakistani Human Rights Commission, arrests are only made in 15% of rape cases. In June, men convicted of the 2002 gang rape of Mukhtar May had their case overturned on appeal, which sparked international outrage. A village council allegedly ordered her rape. Later, President Musharraf prevented her from leaving the country for a speaking tour. In response to Musharraf's recent comments on rape, May told the Associated Press, "Violence against women can only end when the culprit gets punished." Under Pakistan's Islamic penal law, a rape conviction can only be obtained with a confession or the testimony of four adult Muslim men. Two Pakistani commissions have called for the law to be repealed, but no action has been taken. Amnesty International is accusing the ExxonMobil-led oil consortium, building the $4.2 billion Chad-Cameroon oil pipeline, of sidestepping the human rights of impacted residents. The oil pipeline, backed by $200 million from the World Bank, is one of Africa's largest investment projects in decades. As Andrea Schemberg, a legal advisor to Amnesty International, declared, "Human rights are not negotiable items that companies and governments are permitted to eliminate by contract." Already, poor residents in the pipeline zone say that they are being denied access to their land by ExxonMobil, and the oil giant has refused to provide compensation. In addition, the Kribi fishermen, who work off the Cameroon coast, say their livelihood is threatened by the oil pipeline. Existing legal agreements on the pipeline are treated as confidential commercial contracts and kept from public view. Civil society groups cannot examine them. Amnesty says some pipeline critics have been arrested by the authorities. A report by Amnesty International titled "Contracting Out of Human Rights" asserts that without the World Bank's private lending institution, the International Financial Corporation's support, the pipeline project would not have gone forward. California's groundbreaking Million Solar Homes initiative died as time ran out in the state legislative session in early September. The bill got stuck in a logjam between labor and corporate interests. The solar initiative called for creating 3,000 megawatts of solar power over the next decade, nearly 5% of the state's electrical needs. A bipartisan majority passed the bill, SB1, in the state Senate in June by a 30-5 margin. But an amendment in the state assembly requiring union prevailing wages on commercial solar installations raised the ire of Republicans, who said the higher wages would cancel out energy savings from the proposed 10-year, $2.5 billion plan. Now, California solar advocates hope the State Public Utility Commission will push through the program. The plan, endorsed by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, calls for a small increase in electrical rates to subsidize the installations of solar cells for homes and businesses. A Utility Commission decision on expanding California's existing solar rebate plan, currently funded at $125 million, is expected before the end of the year. In 1994, Japan made a huge commitment to boost solar energy by giving homeowners rebates for going solar. Japan and Germany, the current leaders in solar energy, only get two-thirds of the sunlight that reaches the U.S. Eco-activists say California in particular could one day become the Saudi Arabia of the solar age. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
After years of ethics investigations and several admonishments regarding his financial and legislative dealings, Republican House Majority Leader Tom DeLay has been indicted twice and forced to temporarily step down as one of the GOP's key power brokers in the House of Representatives. The indictments on conspiracy and money laundering charges filed against DeLay and two aides alleges that $190,000 in corporate contributions were transferred from a Texas political action committee to the Republican National Committee in 2002. The funds were later returned to GOP candidates for the Texas legislature, a violation of that state's law prohibiting corporate money from being used in statewide campaigns. In response, DeLay has launched a strong counterattack characteristic of the legislator known for his aggressive take-no-prisoners approach to politics. DeLay and his allies have accused Travis County, Texas District Attorney Ronnie Earl, a Democrat, of prosecutorial abuse motivated by partisan politics. But over the last year, an ethical cloud has been gathering over the Republican Party. Two of the party's congressional leaders are now under scrutiny, DeLay and Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, who is being investigated for securities violations. DeLay's longtime friend and Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff is the target of another federal corruption probe, and White House political strategist Karl Rove and Vice Presidential aide Louis Libby have been questioned about their role in the Valerie Plame CIA leak case. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Alex Knott with the Center for Public Integrity, who assesses the recent indictment of Tom DeLay and the public's growing wariness of government corruption.
Recently, he's been charged by the grand jury of money laundering, and this goes kind of centrally back to how the political action committees that he's run and the 527C he's run has taken large corporate donations and then funneled, or at least the transactions appear to funnel the money to the RNC's state component. Well, basically, there's a law in Texas that says that corporate money is not allowed to be used for state elections. And by the shell game of transferring money from one organization to another organization and then to yet another, somehow money's able to get through the system in a way that corporate money can be used in Texas elections. And that's something that, you know, it's usurping the law.
What's been the history of Tom DeLay's ethics problems with the House of Representatives? I know that, for instance, he had been admonished several times earlier for other ethics problems or violations. Maybe you could summarize his history with these kinds of issues.
He was elected as majority leader in November of 2002. Grand jurors indicted DeLay's three associates, Jim Ellis, John Colirondo, and Warren Robold, in a deal with corporate contributions, and that was back in September 2004. On issues like this, various charges, even some RICO statute, there was a situation where DeLay got a legal fund together. He's received money from lobbyists for this, which is against House rules, and he's also received trips to go to even play golf in Scotland from lobbyists, which is also against House rules.
Wasn't he also admonished for what seemed like a bribe of $100,000 to convince somebody to vote in favor of a Medicaid bill where the congressperson's son was running for a House seat, and there was some kind of implicit threat that he would get money for the candidacy of his son if he voted for the measure, and that DeLay threatened to stop his son from being nominated as a Republican candidate if he chose not to vote with DeLay?
Right. Yeah, that's what one of the charges were that went before the House Ethics Committee. And as a general rule, you're not allowed to promise a vote in exchange for anything, especially money. And that's what it appeared to be happening. Also, of course, the political favor that's taking place with that action.
Alex, I wanted to ask you about another ethics issue. Bill Frist, the Senate Majority Leader, he's got some ethical questions surrounding his conduct, his financial conduct as well. Maybe you could tell us a bit about that.
Sure. A member of Congress is never supposed to have any financial interest that could play a role during their legislative actions. Also, in the second situation here with Mr. Frist, is he owned lots of money in his family's healthcare corporation. I believe it's called HCA. As being a close connected person, he would possibly be privy to information that most people aren't aware of. And in very much of a Martha Stewart way, he sold a large amount of stock just prior to a downfall where, you know, where he would have lost a lot of money. The media, being wise to this, is pointing at the transaction and saying that something could be taking place that's unethical there, or that could be insider trading. And currently the SEC is looking into this, which is a pretty serious matter.
Is this unusual for a senator to be under such scrutiny?
By the SEC, yes. It would be one thing if it was, you know, a political charge or something like that, but the SEC is a body that, you know, is not really too partisan, and it would be controlled by the existing administration, so there's just no chance.
Overall, Alex, now that as you look at these charges that are being leveled at some of the Republican leadership, is it a symptom of a larger problem among our elected officials when it comes to dealing with money and campaign finance issues? Does it seem to you that there is a larger problem that could be addressed by deeper and more thoroughgoing campaign finance reform?
Currently with the 527 system, I can still, if I wanted to, write seven-figure checks to influence an election. You can donate as much as you want to a 527 organization. These money machines became a household name during the last election cycle when groups like MoveOn.org from the left and Swift Boat Veterans for Truth from the right played an active role during the presidential election and possibly even might have swung it either way. I think there's a lot of people that are currently questioning the system. They're looking at the large amounts of money that are being spent on this, and they think that there needs to be more reform. Let's just put it this way for a second. $645 million was spent during the 2003-2004, during that cycle. To put that another way, if you take all the money Bush raised and you took all the money Kerry raised and you added it together, it wouldn't be that much. So that's a ton of money that's going through the electoral process, and it's going through these unregulated vehicles.
That was Alex Knott with the Center for Public Integrity. Contact the group by calling area code 202-466-1300 or visit their website at www.publicintegrity.org. As the nation focuses attention on Harriet Myers, President Bush's nominee to fill the critical Supreme Court seat of retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, the nation's highest court has been asked to intervene in a challenge to a controversial provision of the USA Patriot Act. The case originated in Bridgeport, Connecticut, where a library was served with a national security letter demanding private records related to an FBI terrorism or espionage investigation. A consortium of librarians known as John Doe, represented by the American Civil Liberties Union, challenged the government's right to impose a gag rule, preventing them from identifying themselves and publicly expressing opposition to the Patriot Act provisions that allows the government to secure library patron records, regardless of the patron's involvement in illegal activity. In September, U.S. District Court Judge Janet Hall ruled in favor of their librarians and the ACLU. She said the law has the practical effect of silencing individuals with a constitutionally protected interest in speech and whose voices are particularly important in an ongoing national debate about the intrusion of government authority into individual lives. However, Judge Hall's ruling was put on hold by a federal appeals court, and now the case is being appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Gorman, president of the American Library Association, who explains why he strongly objects to the Patriot Act gag rule imposed on librarians and his concern about the loss of civil liberties in post-September 11th America.
Well, there are two aspects of the USA Patriot Act that the ALA and most librarians really object to. One, where you can get a warrant from a FISA, it's called a FISA warrant, virtually without showing any due cause to inquire into library records, bookshop records, financial records, all kinds of records. And the other is where the authorities can just issue this so-called national security letter, again, without showing any due cause or without any judicial review, and just show up and, A, demand that records of library use for people be turned over to them, and, B, that it is a felony for the librarian in question to reveal even that an inquiry had been made. And we find this objectionable on several grounds. First of all, that we believe you have a right to privacy and confidentiality in your library use. And there are many instances in life when people would like to keep such things private, and really it is no business of, in a democratic country, of the authorities, which what use you made of library materials. The second thing is that we believe that there should be adequate judicial review and due course before any such records are subpoenaed. And I would like to point out, by the way, that libraries all over the country and of all kinds have complied with legally authorized subpoenas when the police authorities go to a court and say, we want to investigate this because of a certain crime we're investigating. And a judge grants a subpoena, and it's an open process. Everyone knows what's going on. Everyone knows what the police are inquiring into. So it's the unconstitutionality of it, in our view, the secrecy, and I think the secrecy business is almost, it is linked with the freedom of the press. I mean, if the press can't report on what the authorities are doing, that is a very serious erosion of basic liberties. We believe that particularly now when these provisions of the Patriot Act, USA Patriot Act, are so-called sunsetting and are going to be reviewed by the Congress, that I think it's very important that this John Doe be allowed to step forward and give his side of the story and talk about this kind of basic infringement of your privacy and confidentiality rights.
Well, on the question of security, Kevin J. O'Connor, United States Attorney for Connecticut, argued that lifting the gag order would harm ongoing government investigations. And, of course, after September 11th, the government has taken public fear and trepidation about what terrorists might be up to as a license for the government to do this sort of thing without a lot of scrutiny. How do you feel our nation at this point should balance security with civil liberties?
You know, there's almost by now a cliched quote from one of the fathers, I forget which one of the founding fathers, that someone who sacrifices liberty in search of security will end up with neither. Okay, they come into a library and find out that you've borrowed a book on such and such a topic, or you've been to a website on such and such a topic. I mean, is that a crime? Is the crime in America to read a book or to consult a website? Is it? I mean, it's what people do, not what they think and read, that is criminal. Once you give up that fundamental right to privacy, once you say the authorities are entitled to know what it is you're reading or which lines of inquiry you're pursuing and so on, I mean, that is in principle a step towards a police state. I mean, if you look at countries like China today, China has made tremendous efforts, abetted sometimes, I'm sad to say, by American companies, to monitor and restrict access to the Internet. And I think that there's a huge point of principle here, and I think that people who say, oh, well, we live in different times, there's a war on terror, therefore you have to give up that liberty, are really saying that that whole American constitutional rights, that whole way of life that we have, is worth sacrificing in pursuit of security. And I just flatly don't think it is.
What is at stake, in your view, with these provisions of the Patriot Act as it concerns the public's right to use the library without surveillance?
Right. I think that the public library has been one of the great institutions of American democracy. It's been a place where people, irrespective of their means, their status in life, whether they're rich, poor, old, young, you belong to an ethnic minority or don't, have been able to go and pursue any avenue of inquiry they want, free from government interference. And that's not true in repressive states, and I hope it never becomes true in this country. I think it's going to be like the days of the Red Scare and Joe McCarthy and, you know, the un-American activities thing and so on, where we look back on it and think, my God, what the hell were they thinking of?
That was Michael Gorman, president of the American Library Association. Contact the ALA by calling 1-800-545-2433 or visit their website at www.ala.org. The second Monday of October marks Columbus Day celebrations across the nation, which only became a national holiday in 1971. But as the full story becomes better known of the man who was credited with discovering America, protesters have called for the abolition or transformation of the holiday away from one that honors a man guilty of genocide against Native Americans to one that is more inclusive. Some cities and states have already renamed the holiday Indigenous Peoples Day or American Indian Day. Denver, Colorado is at the forefront of this struggle. There, the Alliance to Transform Columbus Day, led by the Colorado chapter of the American Indian Movement, or AIM, has been challenging the Columbus holiday since 1989. On October 7th, the Alliance will hold their All Nations Four Directions Solidarity Rally, and the next day the group will protest Denver's annual Columbus Day Parade. Solidarity actions are now held in many other cities, both in the U.S. and in Latin America and Europe. Last year, a statue of Columbus in Caracas, Venezuela, was toppled by protesters. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Glenn Morris of Colorado AIM about the history of the holiday and efforts now underway to transform it.
In Chicago in 1893, a very famous speech was given by Frederick Jackson Turner, a historian, about the close of the frontier. And what that meant was that the United States had finally, through the operation of Manifest Destiny, spread itself from the Atlantic to the Pacific coast. But there were other projects in the works to expand the United States beyond those borders into the Pacific, into the Caribbean. The Spanish-American War happened 6 years later. The United States seizes Cuba, the Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, Guam, Samoa, the Philippines. And this imperial expansion of the United States needed a poster boy. And at the World's Fair in 1893, Columbus became that poster boy. They said, you know, who can we use as an icon of the notion that the United States is really this world power and the civilization of the United States needs to be expanded? Well, all of the native people in the United States had already been, quote-unquote, pacified, and so Columbus becomes this icon. So we realized that in Denver, Columbus Day is really a celebration not of Columbus the man, but of the idea of colonialism and of imperialism. And so we know that there's a continuous thread that runs from 1492 to the present. So actually the theme for this year's protest is Defeat Columbus, because we know that the policies of Columbus in terms of using God and quest for natural resources, in that time gold and glory and territorial acquisition, is very similar to the policies of, for example, the Bush administration in Iraq. So we do try to make a connection. But we also try to educate people about why Columbus Day is destructive, not just to Native children, but to all children. Because part of the critique in Denver is how does a society remember its history? And in what way is that history imparted to children?
Why has this movement developed in Colorado?
The Colorado American Indian Movement felt a particular responsibility to deal with this because Columbus Day began in Colorado. And so in anticipation of the 500th anniversary, we began a four-year educational campaign in Denver. And so by 1992, we had organized about 4,000 people to come together in downtown Denver and said, you know, we're going to confront the Columbus Parade if they have one, because this continued celebration without any kind of opposition is not going to go on. And so we had such a strong outpouring of support that they actually canceled the parade organizers, and it didn't return to Denver until 2000. And so in 2000, there was civil civil resistance against the parade, and 150 people were arrested, and eventually the city dropped the charges. There have been subsequent protests each year since then, and last year 250 people were arrested in an act of civil resistance in blocking the parade, and seven of us went on trial initially in January and were acquitted by a jury, and then the city dropped the charges against everyone else after our trial.
In most American cities that honor Columbus, the organizing group is most often Italian, because even though Columbus sailed for Spain, he was Italian. Is that true in Denver as well?
There's been this ongoing discussion in Denver about whether the parade is some kind of expression of Italian pride or whether it's a celebration of Columbus and colonialism. And the notion that Columbus Day was created to somehow honor Italians is a complete fabrication.
You know, as I learned more about Columbus, I was struck by his combination of admiration for the native people he encountered. He wrote about how handsome they were, how generous and noble, and then his willingness to treat them as less than human and, in fact, to exterminate them. He's also been implicated in helping to start the African slave trade.
We believe that a person who is personally responsible for that level of carnage against native people and beginning the African slave trade is deserving of no state or national holiday. And as it's certainly in 2005, there are more appropriate ideals or principles or even individuals to honor than Christopher Columbus. But even more important to us than that, than Columbus the man and whether or not he deserves a holiday, is a discussion about the legacy of Columbus, because Columbus began a process in 1492 that was continued and has been continued by the U.S. Supreme Court, the United States Congress, settler states throughout the Americas that affect Native peoples to this very day. This is not merely about a critique of Columbus the man. It's a critique about how America remembers its history and how that fallacious history then gets translated into law and policy that adversely affects Native people to the present time.
That was Glenn Morris of the Colorado chapter of the American Indian Movement. For more information, call the AIM office at area code 303-832-2544 or visit their website at www.transformcolumbusday.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was performed by Mika Ta and written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.